Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a discussion presented by Boston University's Institute for Human Sciences and Center for International Relations in cooperation with the literary journal AGNI. Tonight's discussion is titled Translating a Moving Target, Poetry of a New Romania, and features Romanian poet Liliana Ursu and translator Sean Cotter. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, AGNI founder Ascult Melnichuk.
The world, wrote Romanian-born philosopher Mircea Eliade, is nothing but language speaking to us by the mode of its existence. What the world whispers to Ursu, though, is extraordinary. While there are many different strains and voices in her work, the presence of the ecstatic in Liliana Ursu's poems is unmistakable and unforgettable. It's there in the early poems, less obvious in the middle, and dominant in recent work. Even lost in the dark wood of personal sorrow or more public tragedy, she is mindful of regeneration as lyric outbursts counteract or explode her speaker's more angst-ridden or somber moods with reminders that nature is never spent. I quote, "Every stem, every new leaf of mint is a letter. In winter, they nurture words underground. Spring, they compose sentences. In summer, the patches of mint are full-grown poems." Tomáš Salamon has called her an architect of light. Liliana Ursu, surely the most celebrated living Romanian poet, was born in 1949 and graduated from Bucharest University with a degree in English. She published her first book of poems, Life Above the City, in 1977. Since then, she has published some 20 volumes of poetry, fiction, and translations, for which she has received numerous national and international awards. A regular visitor to the United States, she has twice been a Fulbright Fellow to Penn State and has taught at several other American universities as well. A prolific translator herself, she has also for years done cultural programming for Romanian radio. Writing about Ursu's poems, Mark Strand observed, "They are like flowers at the edge of the abyss. They are beautifully clear and precise, but behind them one glimpses the presence of an ineradicable dark." Sean Cotter worked in the Peace Corps in Romania from 1994 to 1996. He returned there on a Hayes Fulbright grant in 2001. He has translated the work of several other Romanian poets, as well as written articles on Romanian poetry, including a piece on the great Romanian writer, diplomat, and cultural figure Lucian Blaga. A graduate of the University of Michigan, he teaches at the University of Texas in Dallas. In 2003, Zephyr published his translation of Goldsmith Market, an early book by Ursu, and the first to be translated in its entirety the way it appeared in Romanian. He is, in addition to his many other gifts, the composer of wonderful introductions in which he describes the singular collaborative process he and Ursu have developed over the years. He writes, for instance, "The Goldsmith Market is itself a collection of mirrored poems, the original and the translation reflecting each other on facing pages. The translation is not the precise reverse of the original, rather it works as though it were a sheet of gold, absorbing the Romanian into an English artistic form." A new book of Ursu's poems, Light Wall, is scheduled to appear later this year. I've had a chance to preview it this week, and it's a stunning collection rendered with great vigor. Liliana will read in Romanian and Sean will read in English.
Before giving voice to my children, my poems, I want to thank the Institute for Human Sciences, Elizabeth, where is she? And of course, the press, Zephyr Press, that published my second book in bilingual editions. Only in another German publisher in Zurich published an edition of my anthology in German and in Romanian. But I'm very grateful that these books show the two faces of my poems, the Romanian face, and let's call it the American face, the American image. And, of course, the AGNI literary magazine that published me a couple of times in the translation of Tess Gallagher and Adam Sorkin. So, and of course, to Boston, where I feel at home, and somehow I related to Sibiu, although they have no similarities at all at the surface, but inside, somehow there is a heartbeat that reminds me of my Sibiu. So I'll start with my hometown city, Sibiu, which is a Transylvanian old burg from the 13th century, and where I spent my my childhood. And I think it's very important for anybody to go back to the roots, to the native city, town, village, mountain, whatever, river. And I think this is a way of taking the pulse of your own self or selves, and also of getting energy again. So this is a poem called Gingerbread with a Mirror and Sibiu. And I think I'll read it in Romanian, and then I'll ask Sean. And of course, last but not least, I want to express in public my gratitude for his great work on my work, on my poems, his patience with me and with my poetry. And as Pushkin used to say, that reading poetry in translation is like smelling flowers through a blanket. well, it's not the case of Sean's translations. He managed to turn this blanket into a very thin veil, and I thank him for that again. So here is a poem. You know, the gingerbread that we all were given as children, where sometimes this gingerbread can have a little mirror inside it. So it's a metaphor here about the mirror and the gingerbread and the place where we belong, where our hearts started to beat for the first time. And Sibiu has many towers. You know, it's a medieval town. Actually, I'm writing a book on towers, the towers of Sibiu and the towers of Visby in Gotland in Sweden. So that will be my next book, hopefully. Turta dulce cu oglindă și Sibiu. În turnul scărilor am viețuit cândva, pe când treptele lui uneau orașul de sus cu orașul de jos, cetele îngerilor cu cetele stelelor. Pe vremea aceea scriam tratatul despre iarbă și despre suflet, care este un abur închis într-o lăcriță a inimii pusă acolo de bunul Dumnezeu. În turnul sfatului, când viețuiam, eram pictorul cel cu nume de împrumut, care abia născut am fost dat pe fereastră unei străine care mi-a dat un alt nume puternic de urs, înșelând astfel chiar moartea. În turnul arhebuzierilor eram pe rând soldat, poet și pasnicul focului. Pândeam crivățul și austrul, vântul cel lin și vântul frunzit cel ce dezgroapă colțul ierbii și mugurii din coaja copacilor bătrâni. Dar devenit pe lume, am venit în turnul grădinii de pe strada Balanței la numărul 10, cu coacăzele și agrișele ei ca niște note pe partiturile lui Albinoni, pe care mama l-asculta în iernile prea lungi, prea lungi și prea albe și prea cărunte. În turnul păsărilor eu nu am urcat nici când, doar înfriguratul profesor pensionar, cel care purta totdeauna iarna păsări pe sub haine să-i țină de cald inimii lui, mai ales inimii lui atât de bătrâne. El urca pe treptele din pene și ne povestea despre cum a fost el botezat în somn la o mănăstire din munți. Doar arhitectul, care știa toate turnurile pe de rost, toate străzile și numerele pe de rost, doar el ne putea spune cu exactitate unde au fost cândva casele poeților. Pentru că, deși dărâmate, numai ele, casele poeților, își mai păstrează umbra întreagă. Cineva care ridică mai întâi umbra unei case și apoi casa, ne-a dăruit frânghia lui cu noduri, câte unul pentru fiecare inima a timpului, și apoi ne cerea să-l uităm, așa cum mi-a cerut și violoncelistul acela care mi-a sărutat urechea prima oară, aveam 14 ani, spunându-mi că e o scoică în care doar el aude marea. Loc neprihănit de zgomot și săruturi, să-ți fie urechea, îmi spunea bunica, pe când toca atentă pătrunjelul și-l risipea în ploaie peste supa familiei. Iar eu aveam mereu genunchii zgriați de cățăratul prin cireș și urechile le aveam mici și roze și atinse doar de apa fântânii de sub nuc și de verișorul Bach. Oho, ce mai vremuri, ce mai coșuri cu smeură și afin și fragi! Cum se mai răsfățau pe mesele de piatră în piața alături de cașcaval, de jina și poiana și diminețile acelea din piață de lângă Cibin, când viața nu avea vârstă, ci doar gust de lubeniță, de lubeniță, de lubeniță. Și vedeam eu Sibiul în oglinjoara din turtă dulce pe care mi-o aducea bunicul sâmbătă când se întorcea de pe Valea Oltului și îmi povestea despre locomotiva lui cu care făcuse și frontul și pe care primăvara o împodobea cu ramuri de salcie, iar vara o umplea de pepeni și de pere pergamute. Atât. I think it's Sean's turn to read in English.
It's wonderful to hear the music of that even. It's, you know, it seems, almost seems a shame to translate it, but here you go. Gingerbread with a Mirror and Sibiu. I once lived in the Tower of Stairways, whose steps link the city above to the city below, the flocks of angels with flocks of stars. I wrote a short history of grass and a treatise on the dark mists of the soul, kept in a jewel box heart by the Lord. When I lived in the Tower of Council, I was a painter with a borrowed name. I was a newborn left on a stranger's windowsill. He gave me a powerful name, a bear, to trick death. In the Tower of Musketeers, I was, in turn, soldier, poet, and fire watchman. I followed the north wind and the south, the sweet wind and the leafy breeze that discovers the teeth of grass, and the buds from the bark of old trees. But when I came into the world, I arrived at the Tower of Gardens, number 10, Balance Street. Gooseberries and bilberries, like notes from an Albione recording, my mother played through the two long winters. I have never climbed the Tower of Birds, where the professor retired, who carried birds beneath his suit coat all winter, and climbed the stairs of feathers. He told us he was baptized in his sleep in a monastery in the mountains. Only the architect knows all the towers by heart. Only he could tell us where poets lived. Knocked down long ago, they still have their shadows intact. The person who builds the shadow before the house gave us his rope knotted once for each of time's hearts and then asked us to forget him. Just like the cellist who first kissed my ear, he told me he could hear the sea inside its shell. A place unspoiled by noise and kisses may your ear be, my grandmother once said, while she chopped parsley and let it shower over our family soup. My knees were always skinned from climbing cherry trees. My ears were small and pink, touched only by water from the well, beneath the walnut trees, and by my cousin, Bach. What times, when heaps of raspberries, bilberries, strawberries, lazed on stone tables, beside wheels of kashkaval from Gina and Poyana, mornings in the market near Chibin, when life had no age and tasted like watermelon. I saw Sibiu reflected in the gingerbread mirror that my grandfather bought on Saturdays on his way back from the old river, and he told me about the locomotive he drove to the battlefront. In spring, he crowned it with willow branches. In summer, he filled it with melons and pears.
So I feel like we have been transported already, and I'd like to keep taking us back there, if I may, for the first couple of questions. I'd like to know a little bit more about this fabled city. The first printed book in Romanian was published in Sibiu, which also happens to be, I think, Andrei Codrescu's hometown, and he was here as part of this program last year. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the city and about your family, what it was like to grow up there.
Well, it's It's so beautiful to look through the window and see Boston and see also the towers of Sibiu and Strada Balanze and the beautiful old walls from medieval walls. It's extraordinary because it's very well preserved. The center it has never been touched by anybody, no demolishing and anything. And it has a unique, I'm sorry, I don't have the, maybe I have in this book, it's a bridge called the Bridge of Liars, of Lies, sorry. And it's many people go there, and I remember that once I crossed it, and I was with my grandma, and she said, "If you have ever told a lie, this bridge will collapse, and you will fall." So, and I was like going like this, going or not going, exactly. I was very, and then many years after, I asked my son, I took my son to Sibiu, now he's 28, but he was like 3-4 years old at that time, and I told him the same story. I said, "This is a bridge of lies. If you have ever told a lie, watch out, because this bridge will collapse." He looked like this. And then he went, of course he lied a lot, but he walked so, with such sureness. He was, it's a beautiful city. It was a cultural capital of Europe in the year 2007 for a year. So a lot of performances, symphony orchestras and exhibitions and operas and poetry readings took place there. And I was very proud to be a citizen of this, this place. Well, I was born there, and I spent my first years there with my grandparents, because my parents had already moved to Bucharest, but they lived in a small, tiny apartment that they had to share with other people. It was tough times, you know. And so they let me stay with my grandparents and went to this kindergarten there. And my mother was a great reader, and my grandmother, and she spoke German and Hungarian and Romanian and French, and she was reading all day long. My grandpa was, an train engine driver? A conductor, yes. And he took trains all over Romania, and he was a man full of humor who didn't read much. So I could never understand my grandma and my grandpa, but they loved each other. And also then I heard my grandfather told me an amazing story, and I said, "I must go to America." All the time, it was communism. Everybody said, "You are crazy. How are you going to make it to America? You'll never get there." I said, "No, I'm going to make it," because my grandpa didn't make it. He was engaged to my grandma, but he sold everything he had, land and all the belongings that he had, bought a ship ticket to go to the States with other three boys. There were four men. And but he made the mistake to let my grandma come to the railway station to say goodbye. And, of course, he couldn't leave. They embraced, and they said, "I cannot leave. I cannot go to America. I was supposed to go to Pittsburgh." And then he lost everything, but my grandma was very happy because they married immediately and so. And when I first came to America on a Fulbright grant in 1992, I remember that was the first time I stepped on American soil. I said, "Grandpa, I've made it. I'm here for you too." Of course, he was dead a long time ago, but he understood, you know. Yeah. And and before getting to America, my father bought a car. You know, in Romania, in order to buy a car in communism, you had to wait for years. And suddenly, he was announced by a letter that he can go to another town far away from Craiova, where they made these cars, and that he can go and take the car. And of course, you had to give something to that man in order to get the car that you wanted. So I remember he bought a package of some Kent cigarettes, and I went. It was hard to get butter, so I went and I stayed in line for hours to get to different shops to get like 10 packs of butter, you know, so that my father could have the color that he wanted. You know, it was the color of butter, of course, our car. And then he asked me, oh, I can't drive it. Can't you come and help me? It was February. It was very slippery. Come and help me, and we'll drive together back to Bucharest in your car. And while driving back to Bucharest, he said, well, you are the poet. I'm an engineer. He was a mechanical engineer. And he said, you must give a name to this car. And immediately I said, Amerigo. And I said, oh, my God, from all the names on the earth, why Amerigo? Because Amerigo Vespucci discovered America, and this very car will take me one day to America. Okay, I want to tell you that only my father, Ioan Ursu, that I keep his name. This is Ursu, means bear, and it's my father's name. And since he couldn't have a boy as he wanted, but I said, I'm going to carry his name on all my books. So Ursu is my father's name, and I keep my promise. So he said, everybody said, oh, you're not going to make it. But only my father believed, and he said, I trust you. Yes, you'll make it. And the car will take you to the airport. So when it comes, it happens. And this was in 88, and in 1992, like 3 or 4 years after this, I received my Fulbright grant, and of course, my father took me in Amerigo and took me to the airport.
Well, you're chomping at the bit to bring us here, and I want to keep pushing you back a little bit to this mythical city. The bridge that you mentioned collapsing then was not the Bridge of Lies then.
Of course. Okay. That's good. Eternal, you know, good. Bridge of Lies. who can destroy such a bridge, unfortunately?
A lot of your poetry, nature plays a very prominent role, yes. And often you write about your childhood as though it had been a sort of Midsummer Night's idyll. Is that the case?
Yes. I was the only child, the only grandchild, and I was really very spoiled by my grandparents. And it was the only time in my life when I really felt sheltered and secure. And this was the job of Sibiu, too, not only my grandparents, because it's a town that gives you this feeling of protection. It's a small town, nice people. There were Germans, Hungarians, Jews, all, and we were all friends. And we had as Andrei Codrescu, you know, he comes from the same, maybe yes. He talked about Sibiu. I don't know what his Sibiu, yeah. How it was for him. Actually, I talked to him about Sibiu at a poetry festival in Romania. And immediately we connected. When we said Sibiu, we were like, you know, right. we knew it was our island. It's an island. I think that we all have our islands, and artists, most of them live on islands, you know, and Sibiu is an island, Boston can be an island, I think, and if you don't have an island, why not? You can always build it through a poem, through a painting, or just closing your eyes and saying, this is my island, and I'm happy.
And build a drawbridge that you can draw up,
yes,
at the end of the day.
Exactly.
So from there, you went to Bucharest University and did a degree in English literature.
English, yes, and German.
So even before the car and before Amerigo appeared on the scene, you were already anticipating. That was not one of the four or five languages that you mentioned as part of sort of the daily fare, the norm. So what was it that drew you to English literature?
It's very interesting. First of all, what drew me to English, to the language?
Yeah.
Because this was the first, you know, I think life is made of doors. You know, you open one door and then we find, wow, that's something in here. And then we see another ajar door, and we open that one. And I think one of the most fascinating doors to in our lives can be languages. It's a language, you know, because that language opens a lot of doors for you, cultural doors, you know, real, not only, how should I say, geographical places, mm-hmm. and right. so. And I would call this event that I enjoy a lot, and looking at you, I feel really at home, and I feel like you really respond and understand what I'm talking about, I would call this event right now, right here, not a geopolitical event, but a geopoetic event, right. If you know what I mean.
Sure.
Speaking about places, identities,
sure.
Europe,
sure.
America, and travels.
And
so I had this, I listened to the radio. The radio was on a lot of time, no TV at that time. And I heard English on the radio. And I called my mom and I said, Mom, what language is this? I like it. I love it. I want to learn it. And she said, well, this is English. Why don't you want to learn French, what is usual in Romanian, or, you know, to continue some German that you had in Sibiu? No, this is what I want. And I was 11 years old, and she found me a teacher of English, and she was awful, and she used to beat me like this over, and to put a pen in my, to make me say, with, and it was awful, and I came home crying, and I said, I don't want to see this lady, mom, again. And actually, she wants me to do these things, and she doesn't pronounce correctly. It's not like on the radio. And then came into my life Professor Karol Mašek, and he's dead now, but I owe my English to him. He used to be a very rich man, but he lost everything, and he used to have, I don't know, connection, business connection with New York, so he before the fall of capitalism and communism, and he had a wonderful wife, and the same story, because he was married, had only two children when communism started. He returned to Romania and, of course, lost everything. He didn't go to prison. They had two children. And you know how they could make a living? She was talking about languages and doors and opportunities. And so he taught English for 10 leis, which is nothing per class, se ce le era ora. And she taught German. She had like a German kindergarten in the house. And due to English and German, to their languages, they could feed, put some bread and food on the table for their two children. And he had, I will never forget, on his desk, he had a postcard from with New York, with the skyscrapers in Manhattan. And for us, it was everything. He said, you see, if you learn English, you'll get here. I promise you. Wow. And I stayed like this. And he said, yes, you'll make it, Liliana. Why don't you believe me? I said, Mom, and everybody said it's so far away and it can't be ever reached. It's just a dream and it's not too good to dream in these days, you know. And when I first came to New York in 1992, he was dead, unfortunately. But I wrote a postcard to Professor Karol Mašek, Dr. Turnescu Paișpe, his address in Cotroceni, saying, I'm in New York, you're right, Professor. So.
Wonderful. Before I bring Sean into the conversation, your first book was published in Life Above the City, was published in 1977.
Yes, Cartea Românească, by you.
I wonder if you could bring us back to Bucharest and Romania in 1977 and say something about what it was like for you, what it was like in the country, and what was like for a woman working as a poet at that time.
Well, it's so long ago, and I was living in a small studio in Drumul Taberi, in an apartment building with 10 floors, and that's why the book is called Life Above the City, because from there I could see the other blocks, the other streets, and Bucharest a bit. And it was a difficult time, of course. It was a lot of censorship, and in order to be able to publish your first book as a young writer, I'm the same generation of Mircea Dinescu, of Daniela Crăznaru, of Ioana Diaconescu, Adrian Popescu, Ion Mircea, the poets of the 70s, but they published much earlier than me. I was a latecomer. I published in 1977. And
you waited to get it right.
Yes, I think, you know, all things are meant to be or to happen when you are ripe for them. If they happen too early, then you are a loser. Because you can't really appreciate the magnitude of the events in your life, even of the smallest ones, and unless you are prepared for them, you know. You lose a lot, I think, where you are in a hurry and you try to hurry up things, events in your life. It was very tough. It was a difficult time. And everything was very gray, you know, first of all. Gray, if you ask me about colors, I would say that's my grayest color.
What were the mechanisms, though? Just sort of, did you submit the book to a publishing house? Were there many women who were publishing easily at the time?
Was that kind of establishment? No, it wasn't easy for people who just started writing, publishing their first book. You had to have at least a prize for your poems. So I published my first poems, urged by Gabriela Melinescu. who was working for a major literary magazine, Luceafărul, at that time. And she said, okay, you should publish these poems. And she sends them to Geo Dumitrescu and Ion Gheorghe, two lions, very difficult poets and very strict persons. And for me, it was the happiest day in my life, 1 May, when I received a telephone call from Gabriela telling me, well, the lion said, yes, you are going to have your poems published in Luceafărul. Not trips, not nothing in my life, talking about literary events, books, prizes, nothing can ever equal that sunny afternoon of a Friday day when I got the news that I'm going to be published with my first poems. And they were not censored. It was not a problem so much in those, but when it came to publish the first book, then it was of the major publishing house, it was Cartea Românească, where it was somehow, it was a famous publishing house, and you know, if you published in Cartea Românească, you were somehow appreciated before you were read, let's say. And but of course, the people working for the publishing house, they were okay, they were not censoring you, they were just working aesthetically on your text. But then they sent your book to a commission of censors, people who were just like bureaucrats, I think, with a red pen here and a black pen here, and they started to cut out anything that they thought it was dangerous for the party. You were not allowed to say certain words, to be too dark, and so on and so forth. And I was not one of the writers to write for the party, or even for Romania, patriotic things, because I said I never want to be ashamed in front of my child. I didn't have children at that time, but I wanted to have clean books, and that's how they are. And even of that time. And of course, the book came back to the publisher. The publisher, the editor will come and explain what they ask you to do, what they cut out, and you could say, yes, it's a crippled thing, I accept it, or not. So what I said, the crippled children, the poems that they were taken out, half of them or stanzas out, I said, you better take them out. And so the book was like having like 100 poems, ended up with 40 poems. Mm-hmm. Like Piața Urarilor, or even Viața Deasupra Orașului was very heavily censored, you know. Yeah. And here maybe it's time to say the ones in Romania, if you remember, who worked in the press, in the literary milieu, we are given a list of 72 words. That 72 words that we are not ever allowed to use in the media, and of course in books too. And I remember one of the, anything that had to do with church, no cross, not the word cross, not God, not saint, no monastery, nothing like darkness, nothing like despair. Despair was a forbidden word, you know. Nothing that had to throw a bad shadow on the party or on the people. Everything had to be optimistic, pink, and very, very, very happy. And I remember that then they allowed us, out of this list that came and circulated in the media, that they said, okay, you can, we give you back the word loneliness. Loneliness was also crossed out. And then we had loneliness parties, I remember. And it was fantastic because we celebrated the fact that we could have this word back, can you imagine, to be stolen? I mean, I felt like, as a poet, as if they were stealing my life, my days, my nights. I don't know. How can you not use the word lonely or loneliness?
Solitary.
It was rare there. It was written there. So that's very tough. And another thing that really bothered me, and it was and didn't bother me, it bothered all the poets, but even people, anyone who had a typewriter like we have now computers. Anyone, and of course all writers had typewriters. My typewriter was called a Consul. It was a Czech machine, a little that my father gave me, and I loved it. But then it was like it was maculated because they started to have this law that every month you had to take your typewriter and go to the police station, and they checked They put you, give you a sheet of paper to write something and all the alphabet and all the letters so that you don't write manifest, you call them?
Manifestos,
sure. You know. This is, was in the last years of Ceausescu. But this was one, it was worse than censorship. I don't know, your typewriter, which is so intimate, it was your soul there. You wrote your poems there, your books, had to go through the hands of this policeman and had to be registered every month. This was the most humiliating thing, to go with your typewriter like this and have it maculated, checked, you know.
Sean, so you don't feel... I was wondering if you might, before speaking about your experience of translating the Liana, give us just the kind of most rudimentary sense of the context in which her work arises, in the way that, you know, if somebody were to ask me about American poetry, I would say that you have the twin spirits of Whitman and Emily Dickinson in the background, and then you would have, you know, the William Carlos Williams and, say, Wallace Stevens in the 20th century, something like that, and then maybe something about how you came to work with Liana.
Yes, I mean, to do the portrait without actually using kind of landmarks that folks might actually know about, you know, so not... you can think about Romanian poetry as being some of the most cosmopolitan poetry that you've ever experienced. In other words, it's very steeped in European traditions. These are poets who knew Baudelaire very well. I'm thinking about the 20th century in all. Knew Baudelaire very well, knew Rilke very well, and went through... Liliana is part of what I think is the second great flowering of Romanian poetry in the 20th century. The first would happen before World War II, in which we had this explosion of writers, including Lucian Blaga, who's already been mentioned, writers who were connected somehow sometimes with Sibiu and took refuge in Sibiu during World War II around the goldsmith market that Liliana writes about. So you had this great explosion of writers that includes names that you might be familiar with that became famous in the West, like Mircea Eliade, who Ascold's already mentioned, or Emile Turan, E.M. Turan, Stilron, as we say in French, Ionesco, Eugene Ionesco. These are all pre-war writers from that first flowering. And then there's this difficult period that comes from the decade of the beginning of communism, in which the censorship that Liliana was describing is imposed. And so we begin this round with the entry of the Soviet Army in 1944, the beginning of the communist period in 1948. And this goes up. The Soviet Army is in one way or another in place in Romania until 1958, which is an astoundingly long period in which you can see the actual control just by looking around at people, the presence of the military. And then there's this remarkable flowering in the generation that Liliana says that she's a latecomer to, but really a very important member of. Around the end of the 1960s and the 1970s, this is a period in which, due to certain changes in the way the literature was circulating in Romania, there's all these new possibilities for authors. There's a greater room for poets to be poets, essentially, poets to write about aesthetic objects. If you compare this with poetry from the 1950s, during this dark period that I was talking about, literally, if you go and read the journals like Romanian Life, Viața Românească, you'll see poems that are called things like The Two Tractor Drivers. Right? I kid you not. This is Cei Doi Tractoriști. And these are all poems that have this socialist, realist intent to describe people building the new Romania. And these are all relentlessly positive pictures of people plowing the fields, building skyscrapers, smelting metals, and working energetically for the new Romania, but they're astoundingly dull as poems, and with the changes in the political structure of Romania, these poems were that project of poetry, that project that poetry had to fulfill this requirement, was relaxed somewhat, and so you have like the poems that Liliana was mentioning. This incredible flowering again in the second part of the 20th century. And so just briefly, also a lot of circulation of international writers. So again, Baudelaire, Rilke is a very important presence for one of the major figures, Nikita Stănescu, a kind of reintegration of Romanian poetry with the major currents of European poetry.
How did modernism enter into the current there? Were there Romanian poets living in Paris or in London, or were the poems getting there via magazines?
Before World War II. Well, I mean,
because I know there were translations done of the modernists, right?
Prior to the war. There are lots of translations. I mean, it's also the case that modernism eventually arrived from Romania. If you look back to some of the canonical figures of modernism, you're going to talk about Tristan Tzara and his Dadaism. And Tristan Tzara was the ambassador of particular spirits of kind of this experimental poetry that was already happening in Bucharest. So there's it works both ways, right? It works, right. And these aren't obscure people. Tristan Tzara is a person that many people have heard of if you've read any Dada poetry. But yeah, Romania's always had very tight connections with Paris, in particular, and with Berlin. And so there's a lot of interchange. The area that Liliana is from, Transylvania, was Sibiu is in part a German-speaking town. It's also called Hermannstadt. Right? This is one of the original seven German-speaking towns from German settlements archaic German settlements from the 14th century. So there's always been this interchange. And there's one other kind of slightly cheeky, but I think actually true thing that can be said, is that when you're in that kind of position, when you have a sense of yourself as being part of Romanian culture, being part of European culture, but you're located on the periphery of European culture, you end up having the surprising cosmopolitanism because you need to be aware both of yourself, where you are now, but you're always aware there's another place too where things are happening. Whereas if you live in Paris, you might be forgiven for imagining that there is no world outside of Paris. And so you end up with a surprising kind of provincialism in the capital and the cosmopolitanism in the province.
What was it that made you personally aware of life outside the so-called mainstream, and what led you in 94 to take your trip and the Peace Corps to Romania, take your tour there?
I didn't choose Romania at all. Romania... Maybe it chose me. I had no idea where Romania was when I found out I was going to be going to there with the Peace Corps. I was teaching Spanish, and I told the Peace Corps, this is a Spanish speaker. I really should be sent to some place where, for starters, they spoke Spanish. And it being a governmental organization, I went to Romania. It was better than Kazakhstan. That's where they first wanted to send me. But there was the stamp was wrong on my it was a mistake, a clerical mistake. I could have gone to Kazakhstan. I went to Romania pretty much into the dark, and I knew very, very little. Actually, I didn't know nothing, which was a problem. I knew a little bit, which was worse than knowing nothing. Actually, I had this impression. For example, I'd read Codrescu's account of Sibiu and going back to Romania after the revolution, and I knew that dogs were a status symbol. Nice dogs, not the stray dogs, which Bucharest also had in abundance. But dogs were a status symbol. And so I'm sitting in my host family's house, which was in Cotroceni, turned out to be about four blocks from where Liliana lives.
But we didn't know each other.
No idea. This is where I ended up. I was just kind of dropped in there. And so I was sitting in my host family's house on the balcony, looking out over the streets, and just trying to absorb Romanian, trying to figure out what I was doing, where I was. And I saw that there were people carrying dogs on the streets, and I thought, right, this makes sense to me. My very, very nice dogs, picking them up, carrying them around. A car would pull up, and someone would get out of the car and come around and open the door for the dog in the back seat, and then lean down and pick up the dog, and then walk down the street with the dog. And I thought, well, obviously, right, these are status symbol dogs. This is what I knew. And they don't want them to mix with these stray dogs that are on the street, because who knows what could happen, right? I mean, you'd end up with not so good dogs. It was weeks.
So did you get a dog?
No, I didn't get a dog. I finally realized I was living over a veterinarian's. And I just never learned the word. And one day I learned the word, and I was like, oh, that's what's going on. These are sick dogs.
How did you make that next jump then? How did you connect with the literary world in Romania? And at what point did you begin your work as a translator?
While I was there teaching with Peace Corps, one of the things that is the effect of the Romanian educational system is that you have a surprising, you have this really intense preparation, especially in things that don't need a material basis, like chemistry or something like that. But anything that could be book learned was very well developed when I got there in 94. I mean, 94 was still the Wild West as far as an American going to Romania was. I mean, I was the first native speaker that the English teachers I worked with had met, I mean, of any stripe. So I was working at a high school, and because you had this super production of literature people, the people that were at the high school were much better trained in literature than any.
What do you mean by super production of literature?
Just lots and lots of people being pushed through the system, right? There's then where do they go, right? There's only so many literary journals that you can staff, and the high school teachers that I taught with in Bucharest were astounding. These were people who had the preparation of college professors, and they were working with me. And so effectively, what I did was I learned from them in the breaks between classes, which. Are kind of mercifully long. I went over there with a piece of paper and I said, "Who should I read?" And they would tell me these names, and then I would go out to the used bookstores and show this list to them, and I'd get the books and come back and I'd talk to them about the books that I'd been reading. And so it was really I pride myself that I got something of a high school education while I was teaching in high school.
Always the case, or often not always the case. So how did you first come upon Liliana's work?
Well, I mean, in reading, just kind of reading around, I mean, this is much later now, not much later, 97 is when we first met. And I got back in 96, and as a way to try to kind of understand what had been happening to me for 2 years, I started studying more in a more serious and academic way. Academic at least, Romanian poetry and Romanian history. I read Catherine Verdery's work, for example, which was just very, very helpful. And I read Liliana as kind of reading around in that area. And then through the American Literary Translators Association, I met her in person. The conference that year was at the school where I was studying at the University of Texas in Dallas. And literary translators are, I think, good people because they're always talking about somebody else, as opposed to what I'm doing right now, actually. But usually they're talking about somebody else. And so Liliana was in the country on a Fulbright, and her translator brought her to the conference, translator Adam Sorkin. Uh-huh. And so that's how I met. And they needed somebody to get him from the airport.
I absolutely have to ask you about some of the poems in the new book. It was the novelist and philosopher of religion, Mircea Eliade, who established the idea of the eternal return, the notion that religious ceremony both marked and participated in cyclical movements in the spiritual realm, helping to create sacred spaces in contrast to profane ones. And sometimes, reading your poems, I sense in your work an honoring of the sacred spaces, not only of your childhood, but of the natural world, the existence of absolute and relative realities. Moreover, in your recent poems, characters like Bach, Beethoven, Ovid make actual appearances and revise their symphonies according to your suggestions. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about both that spirit and what lies behind that.
I think you mean my trying to write religious poetry,
yes,
right?
Yes, I do.
I think it's most difficult poetry to write, political and mm-hmm. religious poetry. Because we are dealing here with a lot of clichés, and we are never at the height of the subject, maybe. How can you talk about God, for instance? You have the Old and the New Testament. You have everything. What else can you add to that? All the psalms, you call them?
Yeah,
the psalms?
Psalms.
Wow. This is... You can't go over that. You can't go somewhere there, close to them, you know. Today. So, but at the same time, my soul, who craves for God, and I feel so close, and I feel so protected, and I feel I have to perfect myself just for His sake, for Jesus. And I love a lot His mother, the Virgin Mary. And I tried to write for Virgin Mary for some poems. It's so difficult. Only one I will keep from out of the poems that I wrote. Because maybe I'm not prepared, I think, but I feel the need. It's very powerful in me. And reading a lot of Roman Melodul or all this Byzantine old religious poetry and
and songs, you know. They're amazing. They are so simple and powerful and so full of very special energy. Of course, God is special. How can we compete with him? But we forget him so many times. But when he comes back, then I feel like building him. So the title of this book is Light Wall. What is this light wall? Well, it could be a wall in Bucharest. I don't know whether you have them here. In tall buildings, in the basement, in front of the basement windows, they built a kind of a concrete wall like this, about 1 meter. You must have them here, probably. It's called Zidul de Lumina. It's called in Romanian Zidul de Lumina. What does it do? It reflects the sun and gives some light to the poor people living in the basement. It's a reflection. It's like acting like a mirror, and they can have the basement. People can get some light, hopefully. And I think poetry and the task of a poet is to borrow light, because he's gifted. He gets his life from God. But also you have the responsibility to give back this light, and to give it back to whom? To people, to men, to women, to children. It's very hard, but this is a task of a lifetime. And in this way, you can perfect yourself, because otherwise, if you don't have any evolution, moral and religious evolution, then I think, what am I here for? I mean, I'm asking myself a lot of questions. I think everybody does. And sometimes I find the answers and not. But anyway, I try through my poetry to build a wall, a light of wall, to give some shelter, some protection. If one of my readers feels happy or feels less unhappy after reading a poem of mine, then I can say, yes, it worked out. It's worth writing. It's worth going on, although it's not easy. All the writers know this, but at the same time, it's a great thing. So when the book also and my evolution in poetry, I started from these light walls, metaphorically speaking, the light walls for basements, something very low and very earthly, and then I'm trying little by little to reach like a bird, to go higher and higher, and to reach the real light wall, which is God, you know, and which are his saints.
Liliana, Sean, this has been Sacred Time. Thank you.
This is WBUR. You've been listening to a discussion with Romanian poet Liliana Ursu and translator Sean Cotter, titled Translating a Moving Target, Poetry of a New Romania. Tonight's discussion was presented by Boston University's Institute for Human Sciences and Center for International Relations in cooperation with the literary journal AGNI. Tonight's moderator was AGNI founder Oskold Melnichuk. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Jared Mooney and Edward Mazulis. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.